if you're like me, who is not a native speaker, you may not actually know what that word means. It's a very beautiful word to look at. I like the double Z in the middle. I did not know what it means until 2002, when Patrick Hayden and Wim van Damme wrote a paper on ambassador entanglement. It means that you try to steal a small quantity of something very nice without trying to be caught. And you can steal a small amount of it because there is a lot of it around. And it's usually used in the context of money in a bank, that you try to take a little bit of that, like, so for every, say, $100 of transaction, you try to steal off 2 cents or something and hope not to be caught. So embezzlement, entanglement is almost exactly what it is. In fact, this word was considered so bad that when the paper was published, the editors forced the authors to change the title of the paper. So in the actual published version of the original result, the title is totally different. You do not see that word there. But the phenomenon was so ubiquitous that it has come back in full force. So this is regularly used nowadays. So let me define the setting for the problem. Again, because this is a quantum information talk, so I don't have a Hamiltonian. I also don't have spins on a line or anything. The notion of locality we have is just that we have a joint global Hilbert space that is consists of tensor components. So we call these systems, like say if you have a hydrogen atom, then there's the nucleus versus the electron. So you have systems that can be combined together for a global system. And so in the example I have on the board, there are only two parts of the global system. We usually give people, we label this system by people so that we can talk about them more easily. So one system is held by Alice, the other one is held by Bob. And so the first thing I want to define is what it means to perform local operation on this two-party system. The reason why they are separate is because someone decided to build a wall between them, unfortunately. And so they are confined to do things on their own. So Alice will perform unitaries on her own system, and Bob will perform unitaries on his own system. Since they do not communicate and they are confined by quantum mechanics, we just assume that they perform unitary operations. Now, if they started with an initial state that's uncorrelated, like a zero on one side and a zero on the other side, then because the operations themselves are local, then if they perform any measurement to the individual system, also locally done, you can't do joint measurement if there's a wall between them, then the measurement outcome have no correlation with one another. There's no mutual information, no correlation between the outcome A and B. Okay? I hope there's no objection to this theory. Like, if you start without correlation, you perform things independently, then the outcome, the measurement outcome should not be correlated. Now, if instead they share something upfront, they share some entangled state or some state that carry correlations, then despite the fact that they perform local operations throughout the evolution, their measurement can potentially be correlated. In fact, you can see that in this diagram, it is a setup for Bell inequality. If they have good quantum initial quantum entanglement, like the state that I wrote there, I hope you can see the pointer, like this Bell state without the normalization here. This is the kind of state that they can share before the wall is built, and then they can do their local individual operations and then the measurement. Then not only they can start to correlate the measurement outcome, this outcome can be correlated above what can be predicted by a local hidden variable model, which means that these things are largely classical and they share randomness. So clearly, this correlated state, this kind of entangled state, are very special, and they're very different from uncorrelated state. So with this setup, I hope no one will argue with me that this is an impossible operation. That the two parties start with the product state 0,0, they do their independent unitaries, nothing across the wall, and then in the end, they produce this entangled state that will otherwise allow them to violate, that will break local hidden variable models. Okay? So I hope you all agree that this is an unreasonable thing to happen in any reasonable theory for quantum mechanics. In particular, local unitary actually just means that you use a different basis to describe your local system. It should never change what you think is correlation. if you have a reasonable measure of correlation. Okay? Not only this should not be happening, this should not happen even if they already start with an entangled state in two other systems, A, B. I will label the system later. So if they already have the green correlated state, if they have to also regenerate the green correlated state, they should not be able to turn the 0,0 to the entangled purple state phi at the end. Okay? Now, this is also impossible. I hope, again, no objection on this one. So the phenomena to embezzle an entangled state is exactly opposite to this impossible result, except you allow a very small approximation to the process. So what it says is that for any state that you want, it can be embezzled by an appropriate choice of the catalyst if you allow some approximation. Any question on this statement? You should be a little upset. let me just, before I go on to...
Make sure I understood. So if, for example, I just have psi, mm-hmm. I do nothing more. I don't have the zero. I just have psi.
Mm-hmm.
Psi is entangled, right?
Yeah.
So then the final state would be entangled.
It would be entangled. But it should not be entangled, and then there is an additional entangled state.
Right. And now if psi is a dimension which is much bigger than the dimension of that zero,
mm-hmm.
right? Then it's a big dimensional psi that is very entangled,
mm-hmm.
and I just entangle it by this u with a little bit with this extra degree of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Then it will look like it's entangled at the end, right?
In fact, this is exactly how it will work in the end.
Okay.
That it require taking a little bit of the entanglement from the green state,
yes.
but it has to be done in a way very, very carefully. It has to be in a very careful way because otherwise you'll be caught having done that. So the whole idea is to how to get this done without ever being caught. Yeah, just like if you have $1,000,000 in the bank, you steal a dollar from it, you're off by a dollar. And if someone knows that initially you have $1,000,000, in the end you find that you're off by $1 from $1,000,000, you're still caught that you have stolen a dollar. So the question is, how do you evade being caught if you try to steal a dollar from the bank? Yeah?
It would be about the approximation where the epsilon and the delta is.
Okay.
Any accuracy is on the phi, is it on the psi that you get?
Right. So if it is okay, then I'll give the actual mathematical theorem. That sentence is to get everyone to be intuitively knowing what the mathematics is about. So it says the following. You choose, I use the hockey stick, it's easier. So you choose the accuracy of your choice. Epsilon is an error. The error is measured by 1 minus the fidelity of the transformation, which is the fidelity between the desirable state and the state that you manage to obtain. So you choose the error of your choice. You choose the state that you want me to embezzle, including the dimension, and it lives on system A prime, B prime. Then I tell you the dimension of the catalyst that I need and what it is, such that there exists this unit tree. Now, I have 2 systems here, right? Each of Alice has 2 systems. So my local unit tree on Alice side can act on A and A prime together, and the unit tree on Bob's side can act on B and B prime together. So what I'm going to do is that once you tell me this state that you want me to embezzle and the accuracy for the job, then I will tell you what kind of catalyst I want, and then what are these unit trees, so that my final state, which is this side, will be epsilon close to the state that you want in the end. And the epsilon is the 1 minus fidelity between these 2 states. So any question on the job that we're going to do in the next 5 minutes? Yeah?
If you had demanded that the final state was a product state between AB and A prime B prime,
mm-hmm.
would it become impossible? Like if you allow approximation so that it has to be a product state, but the AB could just approximate psi, and the A prime B prime could just approximate phi. Could you still do embezzlement in that case?
In fact, this is the example we'll see.
Okay.
The first proof of this phenomena does not have that feature, but the particular method we see today had that property. So let me give a little history of this result. It's really one of my favorite results, so I want to give credit to people who invented this. So that's first observed by Wim van Dam and Patrick Hayden very early January 2002. So I think the biggest achievement there is to even ask that question. We took as a fact for 6, 7, 9 years that entanglement cannot be changed if you do local operations. How dare they even ask that question, that you produce an additional state out from nowhere? But besides that, they provide a method to do it, including what kind of catalyst you need. And the proof is really mathematically simple. It's just less than one page in a two-column format paper. In particular, they put something stronger than what I wrote down here. Their catalysts actually work for all two-party state once you fix the dimension. So the catalyst that they provide works for epsilon and d, but not relying on the specific of the state phi that you want to embezzle. The example we'll see today will depend on the nature of phi as well, but it is a little simpler. So instead of a large part of a page on a two-column format, you see a proof that is only one slide. Before that, let's see a little more specific result on this. So the red curves, this were generated by a former intern of mine, Jesse Wang. So we study how to whether the original scheme can be improved if you demand that the catalyst work for all possible state of the same dimension. And the red curves, the three red curves corresponding to the best fidelity you can perform, given the number of qubit in the catalyst for each of Alice and Bob. And we tried three different two-qubit state that we want to embezzle. And those curves give you the error in terms of the percent. And the blue curves are slight improvement over the catalyst that we can design. So it's actually not a, an awfully crazy idea, because for like 15, 30 qubits on Alice and Bob's side, you can get this job down to like 1 or 2% worth error. Now to see how it actually works, So just to remind us what is the job that we want to do. So let's first describe what are the system and the dimension required for the job. So we want to embezzle a state on A prime, B prime. So they have some dimension that we don't even bother writing down. Then what we're going to do is to choose the system A to be small n copies of A prime and system B to be small n copies worth of B prime. Now, once we choose the system A and B, we'll describe this catalyst state there. So I want to arrange my n systems, A1 through AN, in a circle, and similarly for B1 and BN. And what I want to prepare is a state 0, 0 on A1, B1, 0, 0 on A2, B2, and so on. I will want to have R copies of the 0, 0 state distributed according to the diagram. Then I want a copy of the state that I want to embezzle phi on the system AR plus 1 and BR plus 1, and so on. I want N minus R copies of the state phi distributed, again, according to the diagram. And finally, the catalyst is a superposition of states of this type when I superpose R from 1 through N minus 1. So this is my catalyst. One feature of this catalyst you may notice is that it has an indefinite number of the initial state and the final state that you need to transform from and to. It is a little like if you do not know how much money you have in the bank up front, you have a uniform distribution between $0 to $1 million in the bank. When you steal a dollar from it, you may stand a chance not being caught. And it's similar here. So now, if I start to put down where the system I want to transform in the circle as well, the A prime, B prime, and then I have to describe what are these unitaries. So these are very easy. What we want to do is to take A prime into A1, A1 into A2, A2 into A3, and so on. And I do similarly for the B system. Now, despite the fact that I draw it in a synchronized manner, this is actually local. So Alice does her cyclic permutation on the circle, and Bob does his own. So in the end, this is the whole unitary UAA prime and BB prime that I just draw on the diagram. If you put in the initial state 0, 0 here, then this is the final state that you got. That you have the 0, 0 shifted from A prime, B prime into A1, B1, and you just keep shifting things, but nothing has changed until this system here. The AR, BR with the 0, 0 state is shifted to AR plus 1, BR plus 1. And then finally, the shift go all the way down here, and nothing changed in the middle part until here, this boundary, the phi on A and B n become shifted to A and A prime B prime, where you want it to be. So if you look at only the A prime B prime system, your 0, 0 is converted to the state that you want. Meanwhile, every term in the system, in the catalyst, has given up one copy of the entangled state phi. But interestingly, every time it's taken up from a different system. But the first time it's taken up from here, the second time it's taken from there, and so on, so forth. So actually, if you look at every individual system, you don't notice with high probability that a state has been missing, a copy of that system has been of the entangled state has been missing. And in fact, it is exactly the idea to distribute where you can potentially steal the entangled state that makes it undetectable. And let's check the mathematics indeed. So the initial state is 0, 0 tensor with that catalyst. And just as a short form, I omit where the systems, what are the system labels. I have R copies of the unentangled state and N minus R copy of the entangled state. In fact, I want you to think about this as the initial state and the final state for the transformation. And I superpose over R. Then after the transformation, I really just have another product state there with the final state that I want sitting in the system of interest, A prime, B prime. And then the green state changed a little bit. That's why I put the prime there. And it becomes almost like what it was before, except my summation index is shifted by one. So when you do the, when you compare these two states and check the fidelity or the inner product, however you call it, it's actually at least 1 minus 1 over n. So if you choose small n to be 1 over epsilon, then your transformation will have error no more than epsilon. So any question on this quick derivation, how you can embezzle entanglement from a catalyst like this? Now, you may wonder then how much resources does it take to do this job? And it's also clear from this calculation, because you want the number of systems to be 1 over the error you want to tolerate. So if you check the dimension, then the dimension of your catalyst, AB, is the dimension of the system on which the state to be embezzled, the dimension of A prime, B prime, raised to the power 1 over epsilon. It is a large number in terms of the dimension, but in terms of the number of qubits, you take the log of the dimension, then it's order 1 over epsilon. It's not a small number, but it is something which is not outrageous. And we will see a little later that this is actually close to being optimal. So from now on, I want to make a few extensions to what you have just seen. For one thing, there is nothing particular about transforming 0, 0 to an entangled state phi. It's just one obvious example in which the transformation should not happen. So this method to transform a state allows you to take any initial state eta to any final state phi, independent of the reason why you cannot do the transformation. If you have the catalyst, it's a big if. Now, things start to get more interesting. What have we done here? The initial method by Van Damme and Hayden actually is specific to a two-party state. Before this work, we do not know whether we can perform similar trick to embezzle a multi-party system for three or more parties. And the method that you just saw actually worked for any number of parties, as long as each of them performed their cyclic permutation and they prepare the generalization of the state that you have seen appropriately. And furthermore, it doesn't matter why you cannot do the transformation. As long as you're allowed to perform cyclic permutations and you have the catalyst, then this method allows you to perform the transformation. So let me first give you some references before I elaborate on some of this discussion. These are some of the initial results on embezzlement in finite dimension and in the tensor product framework. Since then, there has been some two directions of generalization. One of them is to generalize it to infinite dimensional system, including self-embezzlement, where you have the catalyst, you want several copies of the catalyst. It's proven to be possible. It's kind of intriguing. In C-side algebra, sometimes you can do some of these things perfectly. So I refer you to some of these later results for the infinite dimensional generalization. And there is a different direction of generalization that has been worked on. Here, the protocol depends sensitively on the instruction, what state has to be embezzled. If Alice and Bob receive slightly different version of the state, that are nonetheless very close to one another, but they're not identical, then the method that you have seen and all the previously known method would not work. And so it takes a little work to make sure that we cover this case in some quantum information paths. And so that has been done, and we have a slightly different result than the one done by Stewart, Dinor, and Bidek. So now, let me say a few words about some open problems on embezzlement before I move on to the connections and application of this kind of a curious phenomena. So as alluded to before, the original scheme is having this feature we call universal, that the catalyst is independent of the state that you want to embezzle. In our scheme, you actually need to know what state to embezzle upfront. But meanwhile, the original scheme does not work for bipartite, only work for bipartite state and not for multi-party state. So one open problem, we can actually make the multi-party embezzlement protocol work if you do a very silly thing. You just assume that you may be asked to embezzle any state from an epsilon net, and then you prepare the ability to embezzle every one of them on the epsilon net. Then, depending on which one you ask to embezzle, you use the correct catalyst. This actually sounds like a very silly idea, but this is the only idea we know to make the second scheme universal. So the open problem in the most elementary form of embezzlement is there a different method to perform embezzlement for multi-party system, so that we can be more efficient in the preparation of the universal catalyst? This unfortunately remained open for many, many years. I have been asking this for 11 years, and I think about it sometimes, and I do not have an answer. But I can see there's a lot of students here. So if you have if you have time to think about this, do. So a second open problem related to embezzlement is that in 2003, one thing that we find out is that if you demand for, I forgot the word universal in the line, if you demand universality in your catalyst, there are not a lot of options you can choose. What kind of catalyst you're allowed to take? I also wonder whether there are something similar to it happen in the multi-party setting. How unique is the protocol and the catalyst to perform embezzlement in the multi-party setting? So these are two open problems for purely embezzlement itself. Okay. And I'll give other open problems later on in the talk. So with this, I want to, any question on embezzlement before I move on? If not, then let me mention what else I want to say in the colloquium. You wonder why the colloquium finished in 20 minutes. Well, the reason why I talk about this is not just a curiosity, but it actually has a lot of application elsewhere. The first one I will say briefly is that it allows us to have a sense how we can violate conservation law in an approximate sense and what kind of implication it has. And in particular, what I like is that it allows me to understand how we can perform a quantum gate coherently in a macroscopic system. The second thing I like about it is that we work on this in 2008 because we want to solve a problem, and we finally solved it last year. It's about building a belt inequality, that is, having finite number of measurement setting and outcomes. Nonetheless, you need unbounded amount of entanglement to maximize. You can't maximize the violation, but basically, with finite entanglement. And I'll show you why embezzlement allows you to do that. I don't think I have time to talk about regression and theorem, so talk to me after, like offline. So let's see the approximate violation of conservation laws. So clearly, we have already seen one. We show how to approximately violate the conservation of entanglement. And there's nothing specific about it. What you have seen allows you to just violate any conservation law, approximately. If you think about local operation as a conservation law in the sense that it is a super selection rule, it restricts what you're allowed to do to the system. and entanglement as a conserved quantity, then the recipe you have just seen gives you one way to break that violation rule. In particular, suppose you can't interconvert between eta and psi because they have different conserved quantity. It can be electric charge, it can be spin, or it can be energy. But cyclic permutation is an operation that conserves quantity overall. So there is nothing preventing you from taking a state like this, if you happen to have one, which has r copies of the initial state and n minus r copies of the final state, and is a superposition over r. If you have a state like this, then you can always transform the initial state eta to the final state psi with fidelity, 1 minus epsilon, using the method that I've just seen. You just cyclically shift the system and shift the state that you want to be in the system where you want. If you do this behind the scene, you're in your own lab, you shut the lab, you don't let people see that you have done it, no one can tell whether you have actually produced the state phi from eta using some means, or you have embezzled it. This state here is indistinguishable from the one that you have seen with the prime and the catalyst. If someone is just presented one out of the two states to be distinguished. So it's a crime that you can, you not even God can catch you, usually, that's how I call it. Once you committed it, it's done. You don't tell anyone about it. Of course, you don't confess. Then no one can have any evidence to charge you and put you in jail. It's really cool. So furthermore, this embezzlement can be done in superposition of not embezzling if you have a system to control whether you embezzle or not. So in particular, the first qubit here is a control system. So I have a zero. If I have a zero state, then I want to keep the gamma state around. And if I have a one state here, I want to embezzle. I want to change eta to become phi. This is completely doable because it is then becoming a control cyclic shift that you want to perform locally on each of Alice and Bob's system, if they each have a copy of the zero and the one. So in the embezzlement case, when we have two parties, then you need an A0010 for each party and a B111 for each party to perform that. It's the control cyclic shift that you need here. And it's again another thing that can be done coherently. And so you can keep the superposition in the two branches where embezzlement is done or not. Now this actually really just break the super selection rule as much as you want, as long as you're willing to allow the approximation to be sitting there. Then this brings back to one of the problems that I was asked once when I was eating lunch with my former PhD advisor when I was at IBM Amazon. He asked me and Michael Nielsen, how do you flip the spin in an NMR system without decohering it? So let's ask why there is a problem here. So you have the spin down, which is the ground state, and the spin up, which is the excited state. They have different number of spins. They have different amount of energy. So you can't just apply the X gate. The X gate is the quantum analog of the NOT gate, which takes a A0 plus B1 to become an A1 plus B0. The 0 and 1 do not actually interconvert because they don't conserve things that are supposed to be conserved. So the way they I believe the way they do it in the lab, I'm not an experimentalist, is that you take photons from the laser beam that comes in from the NMR probe. So you have R photons in the laser beam, and then together with the ground state, you can steal a photon from the laser beam, use the spin and the energy in the photon to flip the spin from down to up. So that energy and spin will be conserved in the whole process here. So this, suppose this, in the abstract, this transformation is allowed. Then it looks like maybe we can perform the NOT gate because we have a place where we can take the energy and the spin from. Actually, not quite. Because if you have taken a photon from your laser beam and someone know that I have sent a million photons, then now I'm off by one, then I know that your initial state is zero and you have taken it from me. Instead, if I see that I have a million and one photons in the laser beam, I know that you started with a one state and you have flipped your one to a zero. So in other words, if I apply this transformation to the system here. At the end of the day, I have the spin system entangled with the laser beam. I have an A1 R minus 1 plus B0 R plus 1. And if I measure the photon number in my laser beam, I would decohere your spin. And that's where the question comes from. So the solution is really easy after we have seen the embezzlement of entanglement. What you should have is not a definite photon number for a start. You should have a superposition of photon number. You superpose between having 1 to n minus 1 photons. Then you perform the transformation that is allowed. So that in the first term, yes, you still have the 1 r minus 1, but you superpose over r. You still have the 0 with the r plus 1 photons here, but you also superpose over r. So that the green stay here attached to the A1 and the green stay here attached to B0. Both green states are very similar to what you started with. The fidelity is, again, at least 1 minus 1 over n. So that approximately you can factor out the laser beam, leaving your spin, again, roughly in having the coherence around with the actual A1 plus B0 around there. And this is as good as approximation you can have. It's roughly, your error is order 2 over n here. So any question on this? This is actually done in the lab. If instead of this superposition, you use what they call a coherence state with the modulation by the Poisson distribution, by the square root of the Poisson distribution. And this is the calculation. I mean, the difference here is that you don't need to calculate to know that it is coherent. If you use a coherent state, it takes about one page of algebra to prove that you roughly get the escape done coherently. That's the note that Ike was circulating at the time when he asked us at Amadon about that. He had the calculation in his hand. He wanted to show us the calculation. But it turns out that you don't need to do the calculation if you think about states like this. But the phenomena is very similar. So that led me to ask this question quite a bit about 2 years ago. Whether there is actually really a conservation law error if you don't control the initial condition. In particular, there was a proposal by Sandor Popescu that we may be able to use super selection rule a long time ago to constrain our adversary in quantum cryptography in order to do something like maybe we can do big commitment, we can do something that is known to be impossible otherwise. And the answer was no, as studied by Kataev, Myers, and Prescu back in 2003. They studied two specific physical models with detailed calculations showing that no, you cannot do any better than without super selection rule under this model. In particular, they show that if you have a condensate, the condensate is very similar to the catalyst that you have seen, then you can have a superposition of different charge state. And therefore, your super selection rule does not actually give you much of any restriction to your adversary. And that was substantially generalized by Rob and his collaborators in what they called the reference frames, which is actually very similar to the catalyst that you have seen. And there, they can show that, again, super selection rule does not help in your cryptography in a much more general setting. Instead of just two specific models, it's in full generality. If I understand the result correctly, though, I don't think this allows us to just perform any operation independent, despite the conservation law. It simulates something without conservation law, but it does not apply the unitary despite the conservation law. And that was what I was hoping to do for a year or two when I did not actually work on it, but I was hoping to get back to this question, can I use embezzlement to come up with a unitary? Embezzlement-like idea to come up with a unitary that will allow me to perform any unitary that is clearly violating some kind of conservation law. It's in progress because I have an idea, but I need to check the performance and the approximation. Meanwhile, if you don't do things fast enough, someone else will do a better job than you. So there's a very nice result by another person at PI, Annabelle and her collaborators, that you can directly perform unitaries using something that also looked like catalyst, but it only worked for one party. And so it is a very, very nice result. Anyone interested, I can tell you what that is about offline. So that allowed us to get over this conservation law, but unfortunately, I can't take their idea to come up with a more efficient way to do multi-party embezzlement because the method require a Hamiltonian. That is the swap itself, and that is not local. And so I cannot use that method in a multi-party setting. So that open problem I mentioned earlier still sit around. Now, some of you work on resource theory. I want to urge caution when you talk about resource theory and make sure that you specify your initial condition. Because if you have a resource theory that relies on conservation law and you have an initial state like this kind of condenser sitting around, you need to deal with approximations and it may run into problem. So that concludes the first part of the application of embezzlement. If there are no questions, then I will move on to the second part since I have only about 15 minutes left. So in the second part, we want to use embezzlement to build belt inequalities that cannot be violated with finite amounts of entanglement. Before that, let me say that there are three ways to say the same title. Belt inequality are called non-local gains for some other people, and I'll explain why they're connected. And maximum violation means that they try to play the game optimally. I don't think I have pure mathematicians here. Usually I give this talk to a mixture between quantum information theorists and mathematicians there. They will say that the set of correlations is not closed, but I will not need this interpretation very much here. So I will not give the last interpretation. So let me acknowledge my collaborators here, Chen Fengji, who used to be a postdoc here and then a postdoc with us for a while, and Thomas Fedick from Caltech. So if I may, let me describe non-local gains and say why this is actually the same as belt inequality. So in a non-local game, I have a bunch of players, say k of them. It's a constant number. We don't specify it upfront, but it's just a small, it's a constant. May not be small, but it's a constant. They interact with a referee during the protocol. They can coordinate before the game starts, but they are not allowed to communicate once the game starts. So that's called non-local games. And in the non-local game, they have a specific format of the interaction that is allowed. So at the beginning of the game, the referee will draw a K tuple of questions, K1 through Q, Q1 through QK, each of them I call a question, one for each party. And the K tuple, I call it a query. So the query is drawn from a distribution known to the players. The referee is not going to cheat. He's just going to pick the query according to the pre-agreed upon distribution. Then he sent one question to each party. So the party only see their own question. They will not know the query in general. And they have to give an answer back to the referee, who then decide whether they win or lose. So for every query, I'll use the talking stick, for every query, there will be a subset of the joint answer, the capable of answers, that will be considered winning, and the rest are losing. Now, the goal for the player, they cooperate, they play as a team. Their goal is to win, and they want to win with the best probability possible. Our goal is to understand whether entanglement helps them or not. This is an example that is quite familiar to a lot of us. It's called the GXC game. There are only three players, and so these queries are triples. And each question takes one out of two possible values. It's either a small x or a small y. But not all the triples are allowed. There are only four of them being allowed, and they are each drawn with probably 1/4. They each come with even number of Ys. The answers are either 1 or minus 1. And the winning condition is such that if the query is XXX, then the product of the answer should be 1. If the query is any of the ones with the two Ys, then the product of the answer should be minus 1. Now, this is any question on the game. Pretty simple rules here, right? It is not hard to show that if you have a deterministic classical strategy, which means that whenever Alice, the first player, sees small x, then the answer will be either 1 or minus 1. If they make up their mind, whenever I see an X, I will say something. Whenever I see a Y, I will say something like this. you can see that they cannot win all four queries. At least one of them will be bad. From there, you can also conclude that if they share randomness, they cannot do better because it's just a complex combination of deterministic strategies. So 3/4 is the best they can do if they share randomness. If they share a GXC state, I'll leave you to verify offline. They see small x, they measure along the eigenbasis of sigma x. If they see small y, they measure along the eigenbasis of small y. If they do that, their answers plus or minus one will always allow them to win. So furthermore, not only this game can be helped when you have entanglement between the parties, it also has a very nice property called rigidity, that if the parties win with probability one, their strategy is the one that I told you, up to a local isometry in the state that will be undone by the measurement basis. You can always convert the basis of the state. You can always rotate your state and then undo the rotation and merge the second undoing with the measurement. So you can't really control the state and the measurement, but up to an isometry like that, the optimal strategy is unique. Not only is unique, if it is epsilon close to optimal, your strategy is epsilon close to the unique one that we have just seen. So it's nice and rigid. So for those who usually think about Bell inequality, why this is the same as Bell inequality here? The question to the player is actually the measurement setting. The answers are the measurement outcomes. Your probability of winning itself is a Bell inequality. There are many others that are related to this fundamental one. And the classical strategy with shared randomness in the non-local game correspond to local hidden variable model. So these are the same thing with a quick translation. And when we say that Bell inequality is violated, it means that it's an entangled strategy that strictly improves the winning probability better than any of the classical strategies. So these are two identical concepts. And it's a little easier to think about the motivation and what we're talking about in non-local games. So that's the framework I'll stick to. So I think I'm preaching to the choir here. For the physicists, clearly you want to think about Bell inequality because that allows you to rule out one out of two competing theory of physics. You compare between quantum mechanics and local hidden variable theory. If you see violation of Bell inequality, you know that you do not have local hidden variable model. It doesn't prove that you have quantum mechanics, but it rule out one out of the two competing possibilities for you. If you are a computer scientist, this is also an important concept because it allows you to understand the basic form of interaction, just one question out and one answer back in the multi-party proof system. These answers are supposed to help you understand whether the answer is yes or no in a computational problem. And the class of problem you can solve by asking one question out and one question back in to non-communicating party is actually a very large set. So there is a lot of work done trying to understand what happened when you allow them to share entanglement up front. And there's some recent progress on that. These I already mentioned. If you are in quantum information and you want to perform cryptography, non-local games that are rigid also give you a very useful tool to obtain secret key out of rigidity, that you know the state that has been shared and you know what measurement has been used to generate the outcome. And you can verify that this outcome will not be known by anyone else besides the party who tried to generate the key. So non-local game has a fair number of applications elsewhere. In this talk, we try to ask a slightly more focused question. We just want to know if entanglement helped the parties to win the game, and they are finally made questions and answers. Can we assume that the entanglement is final, or it need not be the case? Around 2009, there is a conjecture floating around that maybe there are some very small games with finite number of questions and answers that nonetheless require unbounded amount of entanglement in the sense that more entanglement always strictly increase your probability of winning. I won't hold the suspense. The conjecture is true. We worked really hard on it. It was proposed in 2009 because of strong numerical evidence by Pat and Vitasi, along with a candidate belt inequality called I-3322. This is still unresolved. It was first proved to be the case, the conjecture itself, that such game can happen by Wurzlafter next office. In 2017, his game has two parties and several hundred questions and answers each. And it's an existential result that he proved that a game like this must exist. Soon afterwards, because a lot of us has worked on this on and off for many, many years, so once you know that someone had done it, you think that my method must also work too. So first and afterwards, my other colleague, Vern Paulsen, together with his group, found a different proof on a slightly different system, also initial existential. In his case, you have five questions for each of the two parties and two answers each. The Vidic added on to the Slavtra is a slightly different result, that if you're not trying to be optimal, but you're epsilon from optimal, do you have a lower bound on the dimension of the entangled state that you must share? So this is a kind of a robust version of the conjecture that we asked. So they did that for the game that Slavtra proved to exist. They did not write down the game, but they together show that whatever game that exists has that feature, and they have a lower bound on the dimension on the entangled system that is required. That's what I meant with the green part. So we will see a game for the next 5 minutes or so. I hope I have enough time, which actually shows why. It is an explicit game, you know what it is. And the reason is embezzlement. You make embezzlement part of the game, and that was generalized. So we need three parties, and that was improved by Andrea Colodangelo, who will be visiting the next 2 weeks, to two party 2 months ago. Meanwhile, last year, they also have a related result that is also explicit, but it doesn't use embezzlement, and it has two parties, and it shows a slightly different result, which is the same. I mean, it proved the same conjecture, but it is a slightly different way to do it, which has the feature that the entangled state, when the dimension get bigger and bigger, converges to something. Our state does not have that feature. So our game has three parties. Each of them receive 1 out of 12 questions. One of them give 1 out of 8 answers. The other two have 1 out of 4 answers to give. All the proofs are elementary, nothing more than a couple of pages. And we have physical understanding. The way we did it was to turn a different game into a non-local game. And I'll hope to quickly describe that game as well. That game in 2008 is a two-party game. It is not a non-local game because the question and answers are quantum systems. The questions have 3 dimensions each, and the answers have 2 dimensions each. And it is very clearly based on embezzlement. And so we have some understanding why they need more and more entanglement to win with better and better probability. So what is interesting about embezzlement is not just that you can do it better and better. If you have a fixed dimension in your catalyst, you can prove that you cannot do better than that. You have a lower bound on the error because it comes from an impossibility result. It's impossible upfront. The fact that you can approximate just means that the no-go is a little discontinuous. It has poor continuity. That's how I think about it. But poor continuity is still continuity. And so if you only have n dimension, big n dimension in your catalyst, and you can embezzle with fidelity at least 1 minus epsilon, the same terminology as before, but big n is now the actual dimension on the catalyst, then the error is at least the entanglement in the state that you have embezzled divided by log of the lower dimension and the whole thing squared. So the scheme that you have seen does not have the square there. And that's what I mean by the fact that it is near optimal. It's just off by 1 in the degree in that polynomial there. So if you trust that, yes, if you have finite number of, you have a limited dimension, you can only embezzle with limited accuracy, then we're in good shape to talk about games that require more and more entanglement to play better and better. So the first, let me generalize the local game to games with quantum questions and answers. It's almost identical to what you just seen. You have just seen. The referee now distribute quantum system to the parties, Q1 through QK, and the referee always, and then the players reply with quantum systems. So A1 through AK are quantum systems. And the initial state on Q1 through QK is purified by the reference system R. Because this will help the referee the most, so we assume that he has most of the information around to decide whether the parties win or lose. And the winning condition is just a true outcome measurement. Either they win or lose. You can always do that. And everything is known to the players, the initial state and the winning conditions. But they're limited because they only have one system out of the K plus one total. And the goal is to convert the state here, the final state from A1, A2 through AK and R. They want this to be in a particular state that allow them to win in the two outcome measurement in the end. And once again, we want to know how entanglement can help them win better and better, and how much entanglement is needed and so on. So to see an example, and this is the only example we ever need, we focus on only two parties. So I just relabel the questions and answer. Questions are now XY, answers are AB. And in this case, Alice and Bob, again, they can't communicate, so they do their own individual unitary. And they allow, and we allow them to share an entangled state. I label the system ENF. The initial state for this game is this one. So it is a superposition between two things. The zero held by the reference, referee is holding zero, and then Alice and Bob are given the product state, or the referee is holding one, and they're given a maximum entangled state on 2 qubit, but orthogonal to the 0, 0. And that's the initial state for the game. They win if the referee finds the final state in the GXC state. It's a very simple game, again. If you eyeball the initial and the final state, and you are Alice and Bob, what you want to do is to take that 1-1 plus 2-2 state and turn it to 1-1. This is what you really want to do, but you can't just throw that state away and replace it by 1-1, because if you do, you'll break the coherence between the two terms. And the referee is holding the reference, so if you break the coherence, if you have this state mixed with that one, you only have half probability to pass here. And that's not a good idea. So one way they can win with probability close to one is to reverse embezzle the 1-1 plus 2-2 state away if they find that they are in this space. So the way they find it in this space is to take in an auxiliary system with a zero. They ask, is my state in 0 or the span of 1 and 2? If the latter, they condition on that, do the embezzlement. Remember, that conditional embezzlement is allowed. And they produce that whether they are in the space span by 0 versus 1, 2 locally. So they each have a copy of that information. They perform that condition embezzlement, and then they erase coherently. They just reverse that writing of the information on the individual system. So they can perform this reverse embezzlement condition on the fact that the system is in the span of 1-2. Now, this is one possible solution for them to win. There's no reason why they can't win with a lot less entanglement. They can play the game without embezzlement. They can do a lot of things. We can't control what they do. So we do not prove that they must embezzle. What we did was to directly just use linear algebra to prove them. It's like most of the page of single column paper with huge line spacing between them. We just directly prove that the probability of winning for whatever entangled state they have is no better than 1 minus log the dimension of one of the two entangled systems E, and then we square it and then invert it. We did not prove that they must embezzle, but we proved that they can't do much better than that. So this is, I think, the first example in which a very finite question and answer game nonetheless require more and more entanglement to play better and better. And then we try to convert it to a non-local game because we know that there's an open problem around, and we want to understand whether we can prove it or not, that conjecture. Regev and Vidic have tried in 2012. They turned 3 out of 5 systems to classical. But the initial question to Alice and Bob remain quantum in the construction. The problem there is that you need to distribute the initial quantum state, and it's a little tricky to see how you can get around that problem. So in the end, the solution is to make that referee a third player, and we call that third the initial ref, the referee in the quantum game. We call him Victor and turn him into a third player in a proper non-local game. By doing that, the distribution of the initial state from Victor to Alice and Bob is not the referee's problem anymore. These are 3 players. They have the responsibility to share the entangled state they need to play the game. But now, if we do that, we come with a problem, because what happened to this big joint global measurement in the end? They are not allowed to do it, right? I mean, these 3 parties are not together. So we have to change that a little bit, but I won't go into much detail here. I'll say that offline. Remember that rigidity result I showed you earlier in the GHC state, GHC game, a similar technique can be used to make sure that they have a GHC state in the end by asking good questions and checking the answers to force that they have the GHC state. So the blue, the green box is just a replacement of the binary measurement. And it works with very, very high accuracy because of the very strong rigidity result. We still have a problem. You hope the 3 parties will share the initial state and play the game that you ask them to play. They have no reason to do what you ask them to do. In particular, they want to win with as little entanglement as they wish. I just simplified the diagram a little. So the last part is to have a real referee for the non-local game, asking them good questions and checking answers in the end, so that they are kind of forced to have the correct initial state. And they will also play the embezzlement game the way you wish it. This part, usually, if I give a regular seminar, I'll explain in a few slides. But since it's a colloquium, again, I'll take it offline. But it is not new technique. We have method to impose and force them to do what we hope them they will do. And thereby turning the original quantum game into a non-local game, and there you embed the embezzlement in there. So the more entanglement you have in the EF system, which is the catalyst itself, the better they will be able to win. And this gives one very simple proof of the conjecture. The technical proof of our paper is about 3 pages combined, I think, everything together. And everything is explicit, and you even have a physical reason behind. So altogether, we have this game that you can win better and better with roughly this number of qubits sitting around. Victor holds 3 qubits only, and Alice and Bob each need all the 1/ε qubits. The other direction to say that if they win epsilon close to optimal, then they need to share at least omega epsilon to the power minus 1/32 qubits. Thomas Vidic actually complained about my putting a 1/32 there. He thinks it's a constant. And you should not fuss about what constant it is. Ruth Lofscher told me that you can't do better than minus 1 there. I still have to understand the proof. What is true is that this is an exponential improvement over the initial result by Slofscher and Vidic. They actually have a similar dependence, but it's dimension, not qubits. These are also useful because effectively, what these games are doing is to verify how many dimensions you have in a lab. With one use of the game, you can't really tell anything. It's just one measurement outcome. But if you have a way to repeat independent games, you can start to lower bound the dimension of the entangled state shared by these parties. So it's a very simple experimental setup, a single experimental setup. If you're allowed to repeat it a number of times, it allows you to verify dimension of multi-party systems. So there are a lot of open problems in this subject as well. Andrea is visiting next week. We're going to get back to that question. Yeah, I can see the expression by Vinny. if you have been thinking about this problem for 10 years, the fact that you solve it some other way around does not stop you from continuing to obsess about it. Let's think about the problem as well. I wonder whether there are other reasons why unbounded amount of entanglement is needed for maximum violation of Bell inequality. We saw one, which is embezzlement. The proofs of the other two groups does not smell like embezzlement at all. They look very different. They're very kind of deep mathematics that get translated from the physical system. So my suspicion is that there are quite a number of reasons why we need more and more entanglement. So I'm curious what else may be sitting around to cause the phenomena. So one open problem that has been sitting around for nearly 12 years now is that the quantum game that you saw show another little mathematical theorem. It says that this class of operation called LU assisted by entanglement, so Alice and Bob did their local thing, they may share entanglement upfront. It is not a closed set. If you allow the entanglement to increase in dimension, the more entanglement you have, the more you can reach. There are operations that cannot be reached with less entanglement, but you can start to do that with more and more entanglement, as we have seen in the entanglement game, in the embezzlement game that you have seen. And that is a situation in which you have three input dimensions and two output dimensions only. Even in that small input and output dimension, the set is not closed. We do not know whether you can go with two input dimensions each and two output dimensions each. We asked that question in the paper, but we were not actively thinking about it. But it is open. What is the minimal dimension for the non-closure to happen? Furthermore, there's another even more evil question sitting around. If you fix the input and output dimension, just fix it to be something very simple, 3322 if you want to. Then take an epsilon, take an approximation. But you do not ask what game it is. Do you have a universal bound on the entanglement needed to approximately, to win up to epsilon close to being optimal? We have no bound. Not any bound, not doubly, triply exponential in 1 over epsilon or anything like that, which is a little strange. For non-local games themselves, there's some work on the bound on the entanglement for specific games. Again, I'm not aware of universal bound on the amount of entanglement needed as a function of the approximation and the number of questions and answers, but independent of the game itself. And finally, we provide some small amount of application from the embezzlement game, but there may be others, so I'm looking forward to seeing more. And luckily, I ran out of time preparing last night, so I'm not going to talk about the last part, and my talk stops here. Thanks for your attention.
So should we begin with questions from students?
So this initial trick with using a catalyst for embezzlement sort of feels like we're sneaking into the bank, taking a dollar, but also dropping a dollar accidentally. I'm not at all familiar with the catalyst technology, I guess. Mm-hmm. So could you give some intuition behind that?
The intuition really is to make sure that the bank does not start with a definite amount of money.
Okay.
The bank really is completely a mess. They don't know how much they have. They know that they have up to a million, but they don't actually know how much they have. Yeah.
Any other student questions?
So the state that you get applied in close to the state to which you want to embezzle, is that a product state in chi tensor phi, or is it somewhat entangled to each other, the epsilon closed real state that you get?
So if you have two states that are closed, say if you want to convert 0,0 to a different state,
yeah,
that are less entangled, you do better than the performance I wrote on the board.
Okay.
Yeah, the fidelity is actually a little better.
Okay.
The 0,0 to the maximum entangled state is the worst case scenario.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how impossible is it to detect someone embezzling?
So is it possible to build up statistical evidence if someone's doing it over and over and over and over again by measuring and looking at the numbers of phi and seeing if it drops a little bit?
Right. So the error epsilon I give is for fidelity. You can easily convert it to the trace distance between the two possible states. I think it's off by a square somewhere or a square root. From there, it means that if you have one copy of the state, if you don't know which one you have, the bias of finding out which one it is at best the trace distance. Now, if you have multiple copies, you start to collect more statistics. I think I never did a calculation. you just need to compose that with multiple copy of two states and see how many copies you need eventually to find out. But for one copy, it's you can push it down as well as you want.
Hey, maybe let's throw open to questions from everybody.
You mentioned application, but if we were to do like an experiment, I'm speaking of like the finite bed inequality. We would need kind of a finite gap between finite dimension and finite dimension. Do you think something like that would be possible? Or realistic, do you think it's to take that result and make it?
So I think the difficult part is to experiment on the upper bound on the probability of winning, optimize over all possible strategy up to that dimension. I think experimentally, if you need to verify it, I do not see how. Because you can always say that the experimentalist is limited, and therefore you haven't tried hard enough.
Any more questions?
Have you attempted to make sense of some of your bounds in terms of entanglement monotones? So even though you're achieving embezzlement, the amount of entanglement is not increasing.
Right.
I just wonder, I mean, if you took in particular an additive monotone where you would know that any entanglement that you've acquired in the second system has been taken away from the first system, could you perhaps relate the fidelity to the change in entanglement for certain types of measures of entanglement? I mean, if you look at it from the perspective of entanglement monotones, it's less mysterious, right? That, you know, that the bank loses the dollar, right? Mm-hmm. There's still the conservation law of money, and similarly here, you know, entanglement for an additive monotone will be conserved. So I'm just curious whether anyone has studied entanglement from the perspective of monotones.
It is a little simpler in this case. I see what you're getting at. So because it's all pure state that we're looking at, so the it's easy to write down entanglement measures and so on and so forth. And so we naturally just use the entropy of entanglement, and that's additive. And once it's additive, then the whole bound just come from continuity of entanglement, from finite inequality. But now you're asking, can we sharpen the bound using other monotones?
I think like the entanglement spread would seem to be the relevant monotone for how good your catalyst is.
You can. I haven't tried to see if it gives sharper bounds. We know that the bound is pretty tight because you have a matching protocol. the kind of upper bound, the limitation, how well you can do, and the fidelity you can achieve, they're actually matching depending on the measure you use. For fidelity, we're off by a square. For trace distance, it's actually tied up to a constant. Maybe that's why there is the lack of motivation to check if we can push that upper, the limit a little better. But yes, each of these monotones will give you a bound on how well you can embezzle. And you can also embezzle to do dilution. That's one small little cute thing that you can do. You can do entanglement dilution without communication because of embezzlement. And there is some good understanding how much communication, like you don't need communication, how much entanglement you did share upfront and so on and so forth. You don't need to embezzle every state that you want to dilute to. You just need to embezzle. There's just the minimal amount of spread to allow this dilution. It's a quite a cute result, and it's already in Aaron's paper with the entanglement spread.
So
Kind of a follow-up question. So is there a good condition to know if the state is a potential embezzlement state?
Yes, we did quite a bit of work in that in 2013, my work with Jesse Wang. If you want universality, without you need spread. So that gives a lower bound. The state that we have is a high spread state.
That's somewhere where the monotones may be useful.
That's true. Although the bound based on fairness inequality does not require universality.
Any more questions?
In the game you discussed in the last section of the talk where you get this bound of 1 minus log square, is that bound sharp?
Mm-hmm.
Is that bound sharp? Like, can that be achieved? But, is it saying that as best we can tell that improves your performance or that fundamentally it's...
The square in the 1 over log E, we didn't even ask. Up to a square or square root, it is tied up to the protocol that we have. Because in that case, it's 1 over log E, and we get a lower bound of a square there. So we know that the gap is just square of the achievable protocol, and the optimal sits somewhere in between. But actually, where it is, we do not know. And it's nothing particular that stop us from asking that question. we kind of have a problem in mind, we solve the problem, and we moved on. Yeah.
Okay, let's thank Debbie again.